Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I write the Song of Ice and Fire blog, All Leather Must Be Boiled, at boiledleather.com, which chances are is where you found this podcast. I also cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone and co-wrote the annotated Game of Thrones for the Subtext iPad app with one of our special guests today. Joining me, as always, is my co-host.
Stefan Sasse, I am a contributor to essays for the Tower of the Hand, and I created the reread blog for A Dance with Dragons as soon as it was out, so maybe you have read it by any chance. With us today, as Sean already has pointed out, are two very special guests today, which will hopefully now introduce themselves.
Yes, hi, I'm Elio Garcia.
And I'm Linda Antonsen.
And we are the founders and maintainers of Westeros.org. Pretty much the biggest fan site for Song of Ice and Fire out there, and we are involved in various kind of projects, including the Subtext Edition, which I did with Sean, and also Anne Gruhl, the editor of the series, and
The World of Ice and Fire, which is going to be a book about the setting that we are working on together with George, and which we have been receiving a lot of interesting material lately.
Yeah, and various other bits and bobs, some of which we can't discuss just yet.
I find that very intriguing. I've heard you say that a couple times recently, and I'm like, my fingers twitch.
Yes, he loves to tease.
I would too.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. You know, Linda and Elio would be very special guests, really, any episode of the show, but the real reason that we're having them aboard this time is the same reason why we asked Alyssa Rosenberg to join us during the last episode. And that's because, among their many projects, they contributed an essay to Beyond the Wall, the very, very fine collection of essays exploring George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, edited by James Lowder and published by Smart Pop Books. And it's funny because Elio and Linda's essay kicks off the collection and Alyssa's follows it immediately, and it's this real 1-2 punch that sort of let me know that I was reading something really kind of special in terms of in-depth explorations of this world. And I also think that in Elio and Linda's case, their essay in particular is worth noting because they're kind of tackling a subject that is not as much of a part of the show as it is in the books, you know, for better or for worse. And I think it's really compelling, therefore, because it's not the kind of thing that you maybe get a chance to discuss during all these discussions that flow out of the show or sort of coalesce around the show. And, you know, just the name of the essay is The Palace of Love, The Palace of Sorrow, Romanticism in A Song of Ice and Fire. And I was wondering, Elio and Linda, just like we did with Alyssa last week, if you could sort of set up the essay for us and let us know basically what it is you're talking about and you know, why you found this topic compelling enough to write about.
I think that it has a lot to do with something that George has said and talked about in a lot of interviews, and then he sort of kind of summarized very neatly in a recent interview. I can't quite place which one it was, where he said that he was very interested in exploring when it came to looking at sort of the medieval history and both the horror and the glory of warfare and all these grand historical events. He wants the contrast, and as you said, I think that with the show we're getting a lot of the horror and the grittiness, and we're perhaps not getting so much of the, you know, he talked about, you know, the colorful banners in the wind and the pageantry and all the feelings that stirs up. And I think that for him a lot of that connects to one of his more famous quotes that he wrote on fantasy, where he talks about how people read fantasy to find the colors again and see things less disenchanted than the real world might appear. And a lot of that, I think, the romanticism and the way he looks at the past and the present and how it sort of entwines has a lot to do with his feelings about what once was great and that has maybe decayed now and all these things. I think Elio might perhaps want to...
Yes, certainly the romanticism And by romanticism, I mean the prefaces in the book or something. We're not thinking of romance as in Harlequin romance. We're not thinking Baudrillard strip. We're talking about the romantic movement of the 18th, late 18th and early, up to the 19th century. And it's obviously been a topic that I've been interested in before in my own studies, academic studies. But George has identified himself as a romantic. And more so in his youth when he was younger. And you can see that in his earlier work.
Dying of the Light
has a lot of it, many of his novellas and shorter stories. But to me, it runs through the whole of A Song of Ice and Fire, and it's not about the world, it's about the perception of the world that certain characters have, that the past was different than the present. And the title of the essay, Palace of the Palace of Sorrows, comes from A Dance of Dragons, the name of the Palace of Love on the Woyne, one of the Woyner great structures, which was where Woyner couples got married. So it was known as Palace of Love, but now it is called the Palace of Sorrows. And I thought that was a lovely image because it's that whole part of a journey that Tyrion has is partly through a ruined landscape, and ruins had a very important place as a symbol in the Romantic movement. So I think all of the Sorry, a lot of it should be looked at in terms of someone who is a romantic writing the story and how he has certain characters view the past. Not necessarily that their views are correct, but that's how they perceive the past.
Do you think there's, what are some key, I mean, you just mentioned obviously the Palace of Love becoming the Palace of Sorrows, but what are some key passages do you feel that sort of communicate this theme?
Sure. I mean, one of the obvious ones for me is obviously Ned Stark's visions of the past, the Tower of Joy, which he then, I mean, that Tower of Joy becomes the cairns for the men who died there. So he has it pulled down, it becomes this ruin. There's, the memory of the tournament at Harrenhal. Robert's thinking back on Lyanna, she was more beautiful than this. Ned also talking about the King's Charges, they were a symbol, they were a lesson to the world.
Yeah, that's a shining example. I think that, a lot of people go on about the realism of A Song of Ice and Fire, and it's obviously a very important component, but I think that without the contrast, George is very much trying to, he's got obviously the whole unreliable narrator approach by having each point of view being limited, and a lot of times they are fooling themselves as well, and you have people looking back on things and seeing them as greater than perhaps they were, but at the same time, that's an important inspiration for them, because if you look at the characters that don't have that worldview, like the Hound, they're extremely bitter. He's probably the most extreme example of someone who's lost all those illusions, who doesn't have anything better to strive for. He thinks knighthood is a complete sham, and for others it is something that inspires them and drives them, so that the truth ultimately probably ends up somewhere in between those perhaps slightly glorified or sort of misty recollections of the past, and then you have something like Septon Mirabold's speech of how it is all very realistic and not at all glorious. So he really loves to play with those perceptions all through the books, I feel.
It seems to me that tension is the key difference between what Martin is doing with these sort of relics of, relics of the past, both literal in terms of ruins and figurative in terms of people's memories, and what Tolkien did, for example, because in the First Age and Second Age of Middle Earth, which are referred to on and off throughout The Lord of the Rings, there are obviously tragedies, but you never really get the sense that the sort of memory that, say, the elves, or the memory that's been passed on through oral tradition or written tradition for the characters, is kind of bogus or glossed over the problems that actually happened, because we learn what actually happened, and Noah actually really was that epic and amazing, and the world really
no,
was
that's
that
true. Anyway. I mean, Tolkien is obviously very much about certainties.
Right.
The gods are known to be actual people, and everything is a certain and some quite some extent preordained world where things are as they should be.
Right. Yeah, there's also a world where, I mean, where you mentioned the ages, and of course Tolkien bought into the idea that there is a dwindling, but the first age is greater than the second age, and the second age is greater than the third age, and he writes about, I mean, there's a letter of his.
That melancholy and that loss is certainly, I think, one of the things that George has inherited from Tolkien, that looking back on things and being sad for what has passed and that can't be recalled, certainly with when we meet the children of the forest in A Dance with Dragons and talk about how they're dwindling from the world, is quite similar to the elves passing from the world.
You know, I think the interesting thing there is that we really have only met a very small number of characters who had the opportunity to directly speak with the race that is capable of sort of remembering that. You know, whereas, you know, in Tolkien, there are enough elves running around who were there during the first age and, you know, either were important players at that time or, you know, are just one degree of separation away from them. That, you know, you're right, there's a certain element of certainty that is very tantalizingly absent in Martin's work.
Yes, in George, we very much have it, sort of the mist of legend as he started alluding to now. You shouldn't trust even dates, given how many thousand years ago something happened. It's, there's a lot of surprises probably in store for people as to how the past actually played out. And that goes from the far past to obviously the very close past with Robert and Rhaegar and Lyanna. And interestingly enough, when you talk there about ruins, of, you know, literal ruins, and sort of Robert is a good example of a ruin as well.
Yeah, that's true. He was notorious this ruin of a man.
Yeah. So it certainly goes on the characters as well, and we certainly meet others and that have become ruined and are looking back on. But he's perhaps the most obvious example, at least in the first book, of someone who's changed very much from his glory days. And
now, do you see? I mean, because that. What's interesting to me about this is I think when I first started thinking about this theme, you know, since it is sort of grandiose, I thought of it as sort of a counterpoint or almost even a conflict with the sort of realism elements to the stories. But I'm not really sure that's the best way to put it, because I think that it injects a sense of loss, you know, or even in some cases, a sense of sort of self-delusion that's, you know, very much can go hand in hand with the sort of the realism, the gritty realism that, it, you know, that the book is known for.
Yes, I think it's, as I think we wrote in the essay, I mean, I think, well, not in so many words, I think we feel that it is a complement to the realism in the sense that it provides... I would say a sort of an emotional context and sort of a personal context in which to understand, because it's not just the here and now, but the way that it reflects the past the past informs the present. Even throughout the text, there's always little things that are, and a lot of it obviously has to touch on Lyanna and Rhaegar and Robert and what happened then, but just things like when Ned tells Arya, you know, she reminds him of Lyanna or something like that. You can sense in the character a sense of love for his sister and for his daughter, and a sense of and the understanding that there was a loss there. That, and then you start, you know, where's Arya's story going? You start thinking, is there more, like, if she reflects Lyanna in some fashion, is her story going to reflect Lyanna's in some fashion? And people, especially about her and Gendry, for example. I think just in the general sense of the themes, I think you lose a bit if you don't have that context of this world that was, for some of these characters, so vivid and so there's so much emotion bound up to what happened to them, you know, at the time of Robert's Rebellion and just before that. Which is one of the things, as we said, I mean, as we discussed before, on and as you mentioned, on the TV show, which the TV show really doesn't touch on. And I was actually thinking about this about the TV show. Like, one funny example is there's a great speech from Robert discussed in the TV series where he's talking to Jamie about Summerhall. And that was a very interesting, and I never thought about it in those terms before until I was thinking about this just the other day. Benioff and Weiss very deliberately write a very deromanticized version of Robert there and give Robert an extremely deromanticized vision of his glory days. He talks about the squire who died, who shouldn't have bothered, and how he, you know, cried out for his mother and the smell of shit and all these things, and which is not the Robert of the novel. The Robert of the novel looks back with sorrow because, you know,
that's no longer how he's like, but he would very much,
yeah,
at least he thinks he would want those days back.
He tells Ned, you know, we should just go off and I'll be the sellsword king and we'll, you know, adventure around the three cities. So it's an interesting contrast.
He's the faded sort of high school football hero who remembers
glory days. Talking about the glory days, in the Springsteen song.
It's interesting, you know, because I'm right now I'm rereading Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, you know, sort of parallel to one another. I've, you know, intercut the chapters. Yeah. And I'm not very far along at all. But I've already been struck to the point where I'm keeping open like a text document as I read to jot these things down, that in chapter after chapter, characters will be sort of told a story of a house or a hero or a lord who, you know, had sort of glory days and then fell. Like, Lord Riker's Maester tells Brienne about the Defiance of Duskendale. The Reader tells Asha about the Kingsmoot that Oren Greyiron massacred. Lord Borrell in the Sisters tells Davos about how they used to have kings on the Sisters, and then those kings were deposed, and there was centuries of warfare between the Vale and the North. You know, the Aerys and Okhart and Arianne talk about all the Kingsguards who have broken their oaths. They talk about the Dance of the Dragons. They talk a little bit about how the Blackfyre Rebellion started. Some old man on the road tells Brienne about Sir Miles Mouton, who was killed by Robert during Robert's Rebellion. I'm not far in the book at all, and it just happens over and over and over again. To a greater degree than in the past book, certainly to the extent that I'm noticing it. The idea being that the glory days weren't all that glorious, and if you were on the wrong side, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. This grittiness, this realistic grittiness in the history, is a thing that really comes up in Dance with Dragons and the Feast for Crows. I always think about this sequence in which Bran looks into the past of Winterfell, and where he gets this vision of sacrifices, of human sacrifices, a very dark and primal version of the North, which we have come to experience as a noble region of Westeros, you know, and all these hero legends, Simeon Star Eyes and stuff. We got the inclination by Maester Lewin that not everything of it can be right, because there are knights before there were knights and stuff like that. But if you combine it with a vision like Bran has, and the stuff that Sam can find out in the walls of the Night's Watch, it really looms that there was a very dark past that is now more or less forgotten, and where these legends are simply stuffed over, you know?
Yeah, I think that, George likes to go play with that one back and forth. I mean, if you look at the first book, you get first Robert's view of Rhaegar, and then he slowly starts to add in other pieces to the story. So somebody who's made out to be a monster starts becoming something else entirely. And then, yes, he will take things that we think about, these, you know, noble Northmen worshipping the old gods in a nice peaceful way or something. And then all of a sudden, human sacrifices and trees full of entrails. I think that he very much likes to play with the idea of the history being written a certain way, and not necessarily, I mean, history is what was written down. It wasn't necessarily what happened. Mm-hmm. History is what is being passed down, but it's just a version, and it really goes hand in hand with so many of the themes in the book, with people losing their identities and changing their identities. Everything is quite fluid and unreliable. It's all a matter of who's telling the story and why they're telling the story. And they may not be lying. Most of the time, they probably aren't lying. It's really all a matter of perspectives, and then you're supposed to sort through it and try and find the pieces that are the common pieces, and try and piece together what actually happened. So the whole thing, the past and the present, becomes, and the future through visions, becomes one gigantic puzzle, really.
Yeah, the most keenly romanticized portions of the book, tend to be people's very direct remembrances of people that they knew and cared about. Like, the Tower of Joy, I think, is the absolute standout because of the repeated information that we get of how much Ned admired, the Sir Arthur Dayne, but, you know, and nonetheless killed the guy. In a kill or be killed situation. But still that admiration lingers. And in that to me, it makes that so much more powerful. And a less grandiose example, I think, is the way Brienne remembers Renly because of the kindness that Renly had shown to her over the course of their sort of weird, one-sided, unrequited relationship. The kind of positive interaction with someone.
I think also another example which sort of, again, plays for the idea and turns things, is where you have Jaime thinking back, and we learn that, you know, he idolized Arthur Dayne, and then talks about how, you know, somewhere along the way, the boy who wanted to become the Sword of the Morning became the Smiling Knight.
Jaime is a very interesting example because, in our essay, we discuss him and Tyrion as both being Byronic characters, and this is referring to obviously Lord Byron's sort of. I suppose it's now a cliche, but basically the anti-heroic character who is an outsider, an individual who is deeply charismatic, but is, you know, as was said of Byron himself, you know, they're mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And Jaime is an interesting one because when you were giving the example of, what was it, somebody about the monster, somebody being depicted as a monster, and you realize maybe not. Yeah, Jaime starts out as this cruel monster who just doesn't care about anything but killing people and sleeping with his sister, and you know, he has no real respect for anyone. He has no real morality. It's like, it's just Cersei, and Cersei is his whole world, basically. And then we start seeing his journey through his own eyes in A Storm of Swords, and it starts, and not only does he complicate the picture of the Kingsguard of a time where he admired them, and at the same time, they're the ones who are telling him, you know, you don't judge Aerys, you just do what he says, and if he wants to hurt his wife, if he wants to murder people, whatever, it's not your job. And he starts growing himself and trying to recover something of what he wanted to be. He sees
that the ideals of the Kingsguard, even if, you know, they're men, they're fallible, they can't be perfect. I mean, he's realized that you can't be perfect, you can't reconcile all those oaths, but having that glory to strive for is important for people. So that's why he's trying to restore it as something for people to, he realizes that having a Kingsguard that people aren't looking up to any longer is one of the rots in the kingdom, because people need things to romanticize and to look up to.
That's really interesting, because you're right. I don't think any of the characters who say things to the effect that there are no true knights, you know, the gods don't exist or they don't care, those people, we have not really seen those people produce much of value at this point. So there does seem to be an argument that even though there may not really be true knights in the sense that they're these flawless paragons, it's still worth maintaining those ideals despite people's inability to live up to them, rather than sort of embracing just pure cynicism the way Jamie used to do.
The Hound is the example of somebody who's, we don't know what's going to happen to him now. Maybe there's going to be a religious component to him finding something to look for, but certainly his persona of the Hound, which now is dead, that one had completely given up hope of there being anything to strive for. And that's not conducive to too much good.
No. Of course, then George complicates the picture, because then he's saying, well, you look at somebody like Littlefinger. I know he's a favorite character of Sean's. He seems a character who has no ideals. He seems to have ambition and a desire, kind of wants, but he doesn't necessarily have, he certainly doesn't have any moral ideals other than, you know, what's best for me is good. And yet he keeps outwitting everyone, so how far does it go? I mean, George kind of does this where he keep realizing it's the ruthless people who at present are the ones who keep winning. But, you know, what's the cost down the road? I mean, we can see the cost down the road. Littlefinger keeps winning by causing more and more chaos. And then, you know, but we know, oh my God, you know, there's all this stuff happening beyond the wall, and he's destabilized the realm or helped destabilize it. What's the cost of that? I used to think that he was going to end up being killed by others in Harrenhal and, you know, on the God side, but now I don't think that's going to happen anymore. But something's going to happen. But George certainly, it's such a big series.
I mean, he's enough of a realist that he doesn't obviously shy away from showing that people who are out for themselves and who are just being ruthless are definitely going to succeed a lot of the time. But that's right. the bleak reality of the world. But I think that with there being obviously magical components to the story, it's definitely not out of the question that some of that is going to come back and haunt them.
Yeah, you have to see in this that even the ruthless characters, they mostly get brought down not by their ruthlessness itself, but when they violate their own principles. For example, Tywin is a very rational man, a very cold but rational man, but he gets brought down because of his irrational hatred at Tyrion in the end. Because and Littlefinger, that's my personal guess, would be brought down by Sansa Stark, because she's the only thing in the world where he reacts irrationally without really a ruthless plan in mind, so to speak. Yeah. At least none we could see at this point. And it is this general message in the books that the ruthless people, the brutal ones, are winning most of the time. And they are brought down by their own violations of this conduct. It is a really harsh sentence in the end, but it certainly fits.
There doesn't seem to be a message that those people will stay on top. They do get on top frequently, but it's not. Martin's not writing a dystopia.
No, by no means. Yeah. They are just having the success, as you say, they get on top most of the time, but they fall, ironically, because they can't sustain their brutal behavior, their antisocial behavior, so to speak, because no one can sustain that, you know? In the end, someone has to come up who can offer something else, something more worthwhile, and that's where this part comes in about things you can romanticize. I mean, Dany, for example, she builds this mother legend around her. Even if she burns cities to the ground, she will always be the mother, you know? And that is something other than when Tywin burns down a city because, yeah, well, there is Castamere. That is nothing you can romanticize, really. It is just Machiavellian politics.
Right. The only person that we've seen really kind of celebrate that the degree of Tywin's ruthlessness so directly is Pacell, when he talks about the Lord of Old Town who sealed the city gates and wouldn't let any people leave and let the plague run its course, grayscale plague run its course. They lynched him, after it was over. But he's like, but he did what he had to do, and that's the kind of man Tywin was. But, you know, when Grandmaster Pycelle is the only real vote in your corner, you know, I do think that there's, yeah, you're right.
Obviously, he's been around a long time and seen what works and what doesn't work at court, so he certainly has a good sense of people doing what is necessary to survive, but whether or not that, you know, is commendable or not, he certainly grasped what it takes to survive.
Yeah.
Right, right. I was wondering if what you guys thought about, you know, Linda, you mentioned very early on that Martin has talked about wanting to depict both the horror of war and the glory of war. And, you know, this is an area that's of special interest to me. And I've come to think sort of the way the glory of war is depicted. I think it's honest because I remember there was this great quote from Trainspotting where Rent Boy is, you know, obviously talking about heroin. And he's like, if it wasn't fun, we wouldn't do it. I mean, we're not fucking stupid. You know, and you know, Trainspotting has its more than its fair share of horrors in it, but it also doesn't, you know, skimp on showing the fact that, like, you know, doing heroin can be a lot of fun because you feel terrific. And it seems like the way Martin treats war, in terms of, you know, the depiction of the sort of code of honor that the knights are supposedly adhere to, and these sort of big, huge, grand, glorious battles and victories, and these sort of tragic losses, you know, the rubies spilling into the waters of the Trident and all that stuff. It does seem like an honest reflection of part of the reality of war, because people go to war to get what they want, and people go to war maybe to a certain extent because there's something thrilling and fulfilling about violence deep within human nature. But I also think that this probably is the case that, you know, it does make you feel, you know, provided you come out on the right side, that you've participated in something bigger than yourself and grander than yourself, and you've fought for right against wrong and all that kind of thing. In terms of his treatment of war specifically, I mean, is that how you feel the sort of romanticism plays out?
I would only say so because, I mean, when you look at romanticism as a movement, a lot of it was about the individual, and it was about the human will and the human spirit.
Byron wanting to go and support the Greek right. resistance, who were less than impressed with his talk about the great glory days of Greece, admittedly. But I think that, I mean, I have obviously my background in studies is primarily as classical history, and I've always been very fascinated by the sort of the warrior ethos, and I tend to be quite furious with modern adaptations of the Iliad that depict Achilles as this murderous killing machine, mm-hmm. and who don't focus at all on just how much worth your personal honor and your personal achievements, how integral that was to the fabric of that society. The fact that you were respected and you were accounted a good warrior was really an integral part of the fabric of society. And I think certainly if you're looking at any pre-modern society where warfare was a significant component, I couldn't say whether it applies to modern warfare because I haven't really studied or looked at that at all, but I think that certainly in the Middle Ages it had to be, it was a large part of your worth and your value for a nobleman to be an accomplished warrior and to believe in these ideals, so it had to be part of the whole, there had to be a mythos and people had to believe it, otherwise I don't think it'd be difficult to have people engaging in that sort of warfare. And if you didn't have that sort of social structure, there's a lot of other things that would break down in society.
And speaking of to modern warfare, I mean, even recently in the news today, the other day we had, you know, the whole Supreme Court on the Stolen Valor Act, which mm-hmm. is an act which attempted to prevent people from falsely claiming that they received honors like the Medal of Honor. I find it's in the modern world, the most bellicose cultures, societies, which seem to be, that still have the most romanticization of warfare and military stuff. I'm an army brat. My father was in the military for many years, so I respect what soldiers do, but at the same time, the degree to which American society romanticizes its military shows that there is still that impulse to give, I suppose,
a special place,
yeah. A special status, yeah, towards those soldiers who, you know, defend the country or...
Certainly, being Swedish myself, obviously, and
yeah,
coming in contact with Elio's family or other Americans really talking about the military, and we have some friends who have, you know, family in military or have been in military, and it is something that definitely is completely alien to modern Swedish values.
Yeah.
So while I understand it and I'm quite fascinated by it in a historical perspective, I find it very difficult to apply to the present day.
Yeah, it is the same here for us. We also have much problems with military glorification, so to speak.
I've often felt, this is a topic that's come up on this podcast many a time before, you know, given the cultures that Stefan and I both come from. And I felt recently, as I read and watch more about World War I, that in this country, we've studied the wrong war. We've, you know, World War II is sort of the definitive American moment, I think, in the American
generation.
Yeah. You know, it's the best we ever were. Exactly, the greatest generation. You know, it was this, you know, the way it's remembered is that it's a clear-cut fight of good versus evil. And I think, you know, great evil was done by the side that lost. You know, I don't mean to dismiss that at all, but I almost feel like that it's not really a representative conflict, the way, at least the way it's depicted. And I often wonder, you know, when I'm reading A Song of Ice and Fire, the wars that are remembered and the way that they're remembered, I wonder if there's something very similar going on. You know, Robert's Rebellion is seen by the victors, you know, who now get to write the history, as you know, this overthrow of this lunatic tyrant, you know, who is burning people alive, and actually had much worse in mind, although nobody knows that but Jaime. You know, but it's just as easy when we see the other side represented to think of it as this sort of mad dog warlord, you know, rising up against, you know, all the sort of strictures of society, you know, to for basically you know, a blood feud, you know, and that's not wrong.
No, a good point, but
I think that George definitely wants his wars to be like everything else, very ambiguous,
right?
That there is no such thing as a you know, the white knights and the black knights in his warfare. That they're very few outright. Obviously, he does have some characters one would have to classify as completely evil. I don't think one can find any redeeming factors about Gregor Clegane or Ramsay Bolton. It's not like, yes, Ramsay has a father who's not the
Ramsay
most...
likes dogs.
Yeah.
Because Gregor migraines, apparently. I feel bad for him.
Yeah, he
has just terrible headaches. Poor boy.
Yeah.
So naturally, to murder your way across Westeros when you have migraines, of course.
Yeah, that's totally unreasonable.
you know, I remember in The Sworn Sword, you know, this is addressed so directly with the discussion of, you know, when Dunk realizes that, you know, he's serving someone who is on the losing side of the Blackfyre Rebellions, which initially horrifies him and actually kind of continues to horrify him. But then, you know, he realizes, well, wait a minute, of course I must have met dozens of people who fought on the wrong side before. It was a civil war. Those people didn't just go away. And the way he now starts, you know, through the story that he's told, thinking that there probably were people, you know, with valid opinions, who were decent human beings, you know, who fought bravely, you know, all the things that sort of, the values that had been exclusively ascribed to one side by history, you know, were shared to a certain degree by both sides. You know, so that does that the romanticism that you know, celebrates the good qualities of the winning side, you know, that it's a double-edged sword, and it can sort of dismiss or hide the good qualities of the losing side, and that seems important to me too.
I think,
in that particular situation, of course, he's involved in a very petty, de-romanticized little private war himself.
Right.
That sort of becomes a counterpoint to this large civil war. And there's this just little petty struggle for no good reason at all. And I think that sort of shows that, well, if you have those on a smaller scale, what's really the point of these large-scale wars as well? Are they just as petty, ultimately?
Certainly, yeah.
I just wanted to bring up the Blackfyre Rebellion, too, because I think prior to Robert's Rebellion, the Blackfyre Rebellion is the first major war we know about that has the same potential for being romanticized. I mean, if the Blackfyre Pretenders would have won, I guess you would have had similar stories about the incumbent Targaryen king and how awful his rule was. You can experience a little bit of it in Sir Useless's tales about how he read books, you know. That's just the ultimate evil for a knight in Westeros,
yeah.
being literate. And he was weak, and then you have this true-born warrior that shines in the light and really is a demigod walking amongst men. And he would certainly have been romanticized even further had he won, but now he is lost in obscurity, basically.
Yes, Sir Eustace Osgray is a great example of someone who's romanticizing the past quite a lot, because he, for example, his tale about Daemon Blackfyre and Gwaine Corbray fought for 2 hours straight or something before a decision. Right. You know all that is a tall tale. In his mind, he believes it. He believes all these things about all these heroes who fought for Daemon, and that they all had a good cause. And
or look at in the Mystery Knight, where you have Daemon's son, who certainly romanticized his whole claim to the throne and has this completely untrue idea of what's going to happen and how he's going to come to the throne and all these things, and where he's not lying to people around him, but he's certainly lying to himself.
Yeah. I think that's probably the key of it. George has said, and I think this fits a bit into his romanticism. I mean, I was trying to find the exact quote when we were writing the essay, and I was writing this part of it about the great man theory of history, which is now no longer really followed. But it's the theory that historiography focused very much on the great men, the men who kind of moved history forward.
And you'd write books about Caesar, you'd write books about Alexander the Great, rather than about the Hellenistic period or
the pre-Republic. George says is, you know, every character is the hero of their own story. Everyone thinks that they're doing things that are right or good, and they may do it for all sorts of reasons from the outside may look bad, but from the inside they think this is the best course. And similarly, there's a paradox there where everyone who fought in a war thinks, well, I'm doing this for the right reason. Everyone, every single character who's fighting thinks they're doing it for the right reason. Even Septa Maribol, when he first stepped out and decided to go out and fight alongside his brother and his friends in the War of Nine Penny Kings, he thought, this is how I'm going to get women and glory and wealth and honor, and, you know, never saw a king, never got himself a penny. So every war is, I think there's a certain the paradox that everyone...
People's images of what their lives are going to be like and on why they are doing things are obviously a driving force.
Yeah.
The way people view the world, the way people see themselves as fitting into the world is largely what motivates actions. And again, those who have a very disillusioned view of the world tend to be more reactive than active. The Hound isn't going out and taking a lot of initiatives. Because what he doesn't have anything to strive for.
He's the dog. I mean, servant.
To yes, exactly. He's there to be ordered around because he doesn't have a vision. So visions from very small scale to very grand scale are driving forces for a lot of the characters.
You know, more than any other genre, perhaps, fantasy is sort of driven by the literary equivalent of the great man theory. I mean, that's about heroes and heroines and, you know, and so that's built into the novel, you know, or the novels, you know, this sort of framework for how these stories tend to be told. And, you know, as you point out in the essay, you know, it tends to be more a story of Jaime Lannister's than of the poor sparrows. Although that stuff is present, you know, it's more, you know, obviously driven by these sort of, you know, these unique actors on the world stage.
I think a lot of that is also, of course, I mean, just in literary terms, it helps a lot to give people a person to empathize with or sympathize with, as opposed to a movement of a general group of people. You know, we have the Brothers Without Banners, but it's really Foros and Barricades that we're really focused on when we're discussing them and sort of the opposing tensions that are sort of brewing in that group. Whereas we're not canvassing, you know, Jack Be Lucky and Lem Lemoncloak on every little issue and finding out from them what motivates them. We're just following along the leads of Beric or later on Lady Stoneheart. Having characters as individuals who provide a focus for the reader is, I think...
I mean, if you look at something like a sort of these sort of semi-documentary things or about various historical periods, they may no longer be perhaps focusing on the great leaders, but a program about ancient Rome will often find some made-up person that they can focus on. Because if you're looking at popular history and if you're looking at a fantasy, people need to focus on and being able to identify with specific characters.
Yeah.
So having a fantasy that is sort of a more toned down, without any of... A book needs characters, and in fantasy they're often larger than life.
And I've wondered, you know, just hearing you say that real quickly... you know, the section of the book that takes place in Essos or Meereen, you know, I felt that some segments of the fandom have a problem with that stuff because it's more about these sort of trends in those societies than it is about individual, say, Meereenese characters. I mean, they're there and I like them, but they don't pop the way that many of the other sort of main characters or supporting characters do. It really is more about, like, the Sons of the Harpy, the slave trade, the alliances being formed, you know, the pit fighting and what that means to the city, you know, sort of cultural and religious conflicts. And, you know, maybe there you do see how, you know, it helps for readers to have, like, you know, all that stuff sort of coalesce around one person who represents that, even if it's fallen out of favor with, you know, the historiographers today.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point about Slaver's Bay, but if you had, I mean, maybe what people are really looking at for when they want George to have a point of view character who's Meereenese.
Someone to identify
with and understand the culture from their own perspective.
But I think that it's obviously very deliberate that we're not supposed to feel at home there or understand it any more than Dany does.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately she doesn't belong there, and I think George very consciously wants that feeling that she's not supposed to be here. She is imposing herself on these cultures. They can never be, she can never belong there. So if she started to create a sense of belonging, it might negate that feeling that Dany is an outsider.
Right. She's Byron in Greece.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I know you guys have to wrap up, so you know, thank you so much for discussing this essay with us. I really liked it, and as we said, both Stefan and I both said off mic, your work has been enormously inspiring for both of us. So it's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, and it's
definitely a pleasure.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
great to be invited.
You.
And everyone, as always, thank you for listening, and be sure to pick up Beyond the Wall if you like what you heard today. It's out now, it's available now, and it's very, very good. I really think you'll get a lot out of it if you dig this podcast and if you dig the stuff that Stefan writes and Elio and Linda writes. I think it'll be right up your alley. And of course, check out Westeros.org, like I need to tell you that. And thank you very much for listening.
Thanks, bye.